You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, Christ has risen. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I, of course, am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is very early in the morning, Sunday, the 19th of April, 2026. And this week, I've been working on something very important. I began... dealing with it showed up in my very first book. And let's keep in mind, my first book really, as it turns out, was an outline of my future research program, generally speaking. But I didn't realize that at the time. I was a very young man. I know it's cringy in many parts, you know. Something that I probably should have dealt with already. I only hinted at it in that book. And it is the revolution of the Decembrists in 1825. This is technically the first revolt in Russia. And it was also the first where Freemasonry had a substantial, if not completely guiding, role throughout. Emperor Alexander I, in 1822, said the following: "All secret societies, under whatever name they exist, such as Masonic lodges and others, are to be shut down, and their establishments not to be permitted in the future. And all members of these societies are to be obligated to sign a pledge that they will not form any Masonic or other secret societies, either within the empire or outside of it, under any guise whatsoever." Alexander I, his death, now it wasn't his death, it was his abdication. As many of you know, I firmly believe he abdicated and became the monk Theodore Kuzmich. I have a whole lecture on that. I can't get too much into it, but at his abdication or at his death, let's say his death, politically speaking, there was a great deal of confusion. And this is where the left operates. The left, whether liberal or socialist, functions by deception. Their agenda has an exoteric and an esoteric aspect. Esoteric only for the elites, or for insiders, exoteric for the public. They have to get the public ready for what they have coming, and they do not tell the truth as to what their agenda is, or they couch it in terms that are deceptive. Now, I started off talking about Alexander I. I have dealt with him many times on this show. He supported both liberal and conservative causes throughout his reign. In fact, he was kind of all over the place. Because soon after he became czar, he created the so-called secret committee run by Count Stroganov, who was actually a participant in the French Revolution. Stroganov was the wealthiest man and certainly the wealthiest family in Russia at the time. And he stated, "The best day of my life will be when I see Russia reborn in such a revolution as the French." The secret committee included Freemasons, Kachubey, Nikolai Novoslitsyev, and the Pole Adam Czartoryski. There were many lodges throughout Russia in this period of time. They talked about things like constitution in the abstract, the rights of citizens, and how you could bring the French Revolution to Russia. It was Stroganov, actually, who drafted a constitution for the once the czars were gone. Alexander had a tutor, the Freemason La Harpe, who was the president of the Helvetic Republic that had emerged in Switzerland, actually most of Switzerland, as a result of the French Revolution. In fact, the Helvetic Republic was such a miniature version of what leftist revolutionary governments do. I mean, the taxes were very high. They ran huge debts. There was, of course, a civil war, because all revolutions lead to civil war. And the worst elements of the population seemed to find their way to the top. And he was an active part of the secret committee once he came back to Russia. Other major Freemasons, Rentsov, Trzeczynski, Zawadowski, many of them were cabinet ministers later on. And this is very early. This is, 1801, the draft charter to the Russian people. And people like Radishchev, Speransky, these people were manipulating him as a young man. They had their own committee of public safety. But of course, it only appealed to the wealthiest members of Russian society. They discussed various reforms throughout, the very, very early 19th century. And then they went out of existence. They went out of existence because they really weren't needed anymore. Freemason Mikhail Speransky was a huge part of the cabinet by then, and he was putting their ideals into motion. Now, one of the things that they promoted was the idea of freeing the serfs, but of course, they wanted to free them without land. In other words, they'd be a massive pool of very, very inexpensive workers. So in 1803, Alexander issued a decree called On Free Tillers. So landowners who wanted to free their serfs could free entire villages. They'd go to the commune, make out an agreement. The Minister of Internal Affairs had the authority to approve agreements. But, of course, this was voluntary, and nothing came of it. You see, because those who spoke out most strongly against serfdom, like Stroganov, never even considered freeing their own. Frankly, their serfs were better off than workers would have been in such a labor market as they had envisaged. One of the few was Count Rumantsev, who freed about 5,000. And I think throughout the reign, about 50,000 peasants were voluntarily freed. And there's a big difference between the royalist and nationalist conception of freeing the so-called serfs with land, with the commune, having legal status. And, of course, the liberal idea of having this labor market. And of course, then there's a Marxist idea of having the of collectivization. But when you had all this land now suddenly up for grabs, and, of course, they wanted secularization of the monasteries and everything else, no different than in Northern Europe during the Reformation, it comes down to the building of oligarchic rule. Now, where you had loyal nobles, and nobility was a very fluid concept at the time. middle and lower strata. The middle and lower strata of the nobility were at the same economic level as their whatever peasants that they may have inherited. They were not; these were not slaves. These had legal rights. They also were supporters of the monarchy and orthodoxy. So whenever you want to talk about freeing serfs, it had to be done in a certain, very specific way. Alexander's desire to free them as quickly as possible was not sufficient. The real political situation had to be considered. This part of the first quarter of the 19th century was this increasing Masonic penetration of the nobility, especially the higher levels of the nobility, post-French Revolution. The December Revolt took place exactly 200 years ago. Well, 201 years ago. It was a failed, to put it simply, it was a failed coup by liberal military and political dissidents against the monarchy. It existed only in St. Petersburg, December 26, 1825. Again, following the death of the Emperor Alexander. Now, according to the laws of the great Emperor Paul, who has been canonized, after the death of the childless Alexander, the throne was to be inherited by his next eldest brother. And that was Constantine, also was childless. He was a Grand Duke, second son of Paul I and Sophie of Wurttemberg. Now, he renounced his claim in 1823 due to his morganatic marriage to the Polish Countess Grudzinska. And for that reason, really couldn't govern. He spent most of his time in Poland anyway. But for 25 days after the death of Alexander, he was known as His Imperial Majesty Constantine, the first emperor and sovereign of Russia. He never reigned. He never acceded to the throne. But Nicholas, the man who was to become Nicholas I, swore allegiance to him. Alexander died on abdicated December 1st, 1825. Most of the royal military units in the capital swore allegiance to the presumed successor. Apparently, Constantine had no intention of ruling at any time. And only at this point did he decide to make his renunciation of the throne public. Nicholas had no choice but to assume the throne. This very brief interregnum is where you have the Decemberist Revolution, attempted Decemberist coup. There was a tremendous amount of confusion in the capital. You had people who had already sworn an oath to Constantine. So the liberal and Masonic groups had to convince certain officers to refuse to swear to Nicholas. The leaders of the revolt elected Princess Sergei Trubetskoy, who came out of the Lodge of the Three Virtues as interim ruler. He never even showed up that day. So the succession controversy, which really was the fault of Constantine, became the pretext of this revolt. He had privately renounced his claim at least two years prior to Alexander's, sudden death on December 1st, 1825, or 19th in the old calendar. So, of course, Nicholas would be next in line. And, of course, he reigned as Nicholas I. Most of the elite Russian public, even, were not aware of Constantine's renunciation. News didn't travel that fast back then. So there was an oath-taking. The true Emperor Nicholas scheduled for December 26, 1825, in the Senate Square in St. Petersburg. And people had already given an oath, but that was to be canceled. But it wasn't just that confusion that led to this revolt. This first quarter of the 19th century, you had the conversion of the highest elites in Russia to Freemasonry and internationalism. You had groups like the Order of the Russian Knights, Sacred Artel, Simonovsky Regiment. These are kind of semi-legal institutions. The Union of Salvation was very important in 1816. Formed in St. Petersburg, founded by Alexander Muryavov. And one of its members was Trubetskoy. And people like Ivan Yakushin and the infamous Pavel Pestel joined as well. Their stated goals, their exoteric goals, were the liberation of the peasants, and the reform of government in some vague way, and of course the abolition of the monarchy. Pestel had written the Charter of the Union of Salvation, or the Union of the True and Faithful Sons of the Fatherland, it was called. And all of these, of course, these groups were connected to the lodges. In 1818, there was a new secret society, the Union of Welfare, that was created in Moscow, and had some overlapping membership. Trubetskoy was one of its members, contained the principals in previous groups. But there was a exoteric part and an esoteric part. Its charter had aspects that were not written down. And that was a description of the society's ultimate goals. Now, that has not even secondary source. Of course, it's not written down by definition. But what it was, we can only surmise. That union existed until 1821. It was about 200 men total. The point being was to create an anti-royalist, an internationalist, what they called progressive public opinion, and to make that normal. You know, Petersburg was not a normal city. And they founded various legal charities, you know, what they called charities, you know, literary, educational, whatever. Union of Welfare had 10 chapters. Two of them were in Moscow. None of these people were poor. None of the people who I'm going to name here were impoverished. They were all very wealthy. They came from the highest level of the elites, whether military or otherwise. There were more. The Southern Society in 1821 was formed in Ukraine. The Northern Society, 1822, which was again in Petersburg. Then you have the Society of United Slavs, founded by the two Bratislav brothers, and they eventually joined the Southern Society. The Southern Society ultimately came under the control of Pestel, and that name, it's a memorable name, certainly not a Russian name. You need to remember. So you had a situation in Petersburg where elite military units had secret societies within them, whose goal was to eliminate the monarchy and, of course, clip the wings of the Orthodox Church. The Southern Society was based in Tula, had people like Pavel Bobrishchev, Jefushkin, Alexei Cherkasov, Vladimir Likachev, and Ivan Avramov. And again, every one of these from the elite. So when this confusing transition to Nicholas's reign, the Northern Society, Again, a secret society of liberal revolutionaries, nobles, military officials, organized a conspiracy to replace the Russian Empire's system with what they pretended was a constitutional monarchy. It was, of course, an oligarchy, a form of government that Russia had already experienced in the previous century. Now, in order to, in the 2 years after Constantine had privately renounced, and I guess in certainly elite circles it was known that he had renounced the throne and was going to stay in Warsaw, they had to convince the military that Nicholas was a usurper, taking the throne from Constantine. And that was that, you know, in that confusing period, very short, small window. So on December 26th, the Northern Society members led a force of roughly 2,500 aristocratic troops into the Senate Square to prevent the swearing-in and hopefully rally additional men to their cause, and failed to do so. This group of rebels were very, very poorly organized, a lot of indecision, a lot of dissension. Overwhelmingly, the army, once they realized what was going on, was loyal to Nicholas. Nicholas sent an envoy, Mikhail Miloradovic, who, of course, has a Serbian background, was sent out to negotiate, and as he turned around, he was shot in the back. The loyalists scattered the rebels and destroyed them. Didn't take very long. Secret societies in the very early 19th century was almost a fashion if you were part of the elite. Muyalov Apostol was a member of the lodge, and most of the Decembrists in leadership positions became members. And of course, you know, you don't have to be a sworn member of the lodge to be Masonic in your mentality. Now, Pavel Pestel, his charter was a little different. He divided its members into three ranks. And that had to do with the levels of revelation each one was allowed to know. Again, these men never freed their own serfs, so their entire agenda seemed bizarre. But after that, Emperor Nicholas I always retained a lifelong fear of the elite. And when you talk about him strengthening censorship or opposing revolutionary uprisings throughout Europe, this is what he has in mind. Now, in your textbooks, you're going to read the Decembrists described in the having the highest of virtues. But let me quote Pestel. This is one of the few times the esoteric side of his movement was jotted down by a secretary. And here's what he said. Our council proposes the unification of the Northern and Southern societies on the following terms. First, recognize a single supreme ruler and dictator of both councils. Second, oblige everyone to render complete and unconditional obedience to him. Third, abandon the long path of enlightenment and slow action to influence general opinion, and make decrees more authoritative and powerful than the paltry rules set forth in our statutes. And having accepted the constitution of the Southern Society, confirmed with an oath, there will be no other in Russia. The primary and initial action will be to initiate revolution through rebellion and the troops, and the abolition of the throne. There will be a temporary government with unlimited powers. And that was a bit of a problem for some of the people who were there. Some of the people actually thought that this had something to do with republicanism. Pestel went so far as to say, primarily, first of all, the reigning family must not exist. Then he said, all distinctions of status and rank shall cease. All titles in the very name of noblemen shall be abolished. The merchant and bourgeois classes shall be abolished. All nationalities shall renounce the rights of individual tribes and even their names, except for the single Russian one. Of course, in his mind, as in the French Revolution, the Helvetic Republic, the press was to be censored to an extreme degree. Secret police, spies, and informants among the general population. And while they claimed the Orthodox Church would be dominant, it only would be a church that they had purged in the first place. Interestingly enough, with all that, you know, this was not a Jewish movement. They advocated 2 million Russian and Polish Jews were to be expelled from Russia and found a Jewish kingdom on the shores of Asia Minor. This was at a point where Zionism was not particularly popular among Jews. It was a tiny handful of fanatics. Now, this was a Masonic, I mean, a Judeo-Masonic movement. Pestel was a member of the lodge called United Friends. Pestel talked about the bliss of Republican France under the rule of the Committee of Public Safety. And it didn't take long for him, at least those close to him, saying that revolution required mass murder and the royal family first and foremost. His charter was called Ruskaya Pravda. Which I've read many years ago. There's been many commentaries on that over the years. And he advocated for there was going to be a provisional government. Now, despite what they said in public, the esoteric idea was the uprooting of all state and church institutions must put an end to the line of the czars and forbid existing freedoms. In other words, they were going to be forced to be free in the Rousseauian sense. Well, maybe not in the Rousseauian, what he thought was. Keep in mind that all of this was purely foreign. The Great Patriotic War was the war against Napoleon. And when some of these men came back from France, you did have the conception of the secret political union. But these were all based on foreign ideas. The Charter of the Union of Welfare, for example, was copied from the Charter of the German Tugendbund, which itself was based on European Freemasonry and the ideals of the French Revolution. Equality, you know, universal brotherhood, equality, liberty. But it has to be asserted, it can only be asserted through violence. Nikolai Berdyaev said, quote, the Freemasons and Decembrists prepared the emergence of the Russian intelligentsia of the 19th century, which is poorly understood in the West, confused with what they call intellectuals. The Freemasons and Decembrists themselves, noble Russians, were not yet typical intellectuals and possessed only a few traits that prefigured the emergence of the intelligentsia. That's a very sophisticated insult. Now, in 1820, the French ambassador, Langron, wrote back home, he said, all the youth, especially officers, they're imbued with liberal doctrines. They're captivated with the most extreme of liberal theories. He says there's not an officer in the guard that has not read and reread the works of Benjamin Constant and does not believe he understands them. Of course, he means Benjamin Constant. And it's odd that he says he does not believe he understands them. But they also say that the Freemasons were at the core of this. Later French ambassador, Count Bullocompte, said that, "I had the opportunity to see a list of Russian Masons compiled 5 years ago. They contained 10,000 names belonging to 10 or 12 lodges in St. Petersburg, and the vast majority were officers. The charters of the Union of Salvation and all of these groups clearly reveals what was fashionable amongst Masonic lodges at the time. Whether they knew it or not, whether they were sworn members or not. Now we know what Freemasonry is. I've dealt with it so many times, I don't want to get into it again. But for various reasons, it sought two goals. To undermine the Orthodox faith, the spiritual identity of the Russian nation, the truth, the source of its spiritual strength. That was only one side of it. The other was to undermine the autocracy, the source of her physical strength. You can't have one without the other. A lot of these bodies issued contradictory doctrines. You'll have, and there's so many, even contemporary writers in English, who think the Freemasons were the conservative and royalist body. I don't know where they're getting that from, but I'm sure they can find some track where they say that. It was quite deliberate. The only thing that mattered was the esoteric. And we've already read with Pestel what that meant. So it all comes down to the fact that the Decembrists uprising, the Decembrists was a realization of these plans that had been in preparation for quite a long time. Count Toll wrote in his book Masonic Action, of course being a Freemason himself, "Their militant denial was directed simultaneously against the church and against autocracy. In December circles, the reference books were always the classics of French politics and philosophy, along with all the foreign political works that the French had assimilated, as well as French political literature. The Decembrists were interested in French philosophy. Under the pressure of this philosophy, few of them retained their religiosity. Most rejected Christianity, especially its rituals. Some even went so far as atheism. That was the spirit of the times. Of the more than 100 Decembrists who lived in Chita, only 13 remained Christians. The majority were either indifferent, skeptical, or downright hostile to the faith, in the name of their staunch deism or atheism. They often mocked the faith, in fact, especially the observance of holidays and fasts." Now, he's talking about when he was able to talk to them in their exile after this was all over. That's why he mentions Chita. Boris Bashlov, who I've quoted pretty much my entire career, a royalist, anti-Masonic Russian writer. I take a lot from him, I always will. But he says something here that makes me laugh. He says, "There is a profound misconception that revolutionary parties plotting revolutionary and social upheavals are composed entirely of angels." Now, of course, it's a mockery, but that's exactly how they are how they're depicted. They believe that, you know, what they say, this is what they believe. Their exoteric writings and speeches, this is what they actually believe. The truth is, and not just in the Russian case, but in the British and the French cases, these organizations contain a huge number of people of extremely low moral standing. The staffing of these organizations and parties that attempt to benefit humanity, and Bashlov says, they usually proceed in the following order. The initiators are fanatical idealists. The fanatics are supported by all those aggrieved by the existing system, by those with inordinate ambition, by all who are human zeros outside the revolutionary corporation. He says, throughout history, members of revolutionary and anti-government secret organizations have been divided into five main groups: fanatics, dreamers, the ambitious, the adventurer, and the losers, hoping to achieve something better in a new government than they currently enjoy. Yeah, it's arbitrary. We know that. But for someone who's been fighting these people for 30 years, it's true. You'll find amongst true revolutionary organizations that you'll find very few normal people. Normal mindset, normal willpower. There are very few among these movements. Those who advocate revolution are usually unbalanced. They're failures. The historian of the French Revolution, Hippolyte Taine, who actually studied the biographies of most of the revolution's outstanding figures, came to this conclusion. He said they were people knocked out of the rut of life, madmen and scoundrels of every kind and every class, especially the lower ones, envious and embittered subordinates, merchants confused in business, drunken and idle employees, regulars of cafes and taverns, city and village vagabonds, street women. In a word, all sorts of parasites in society. Among this rabble are a few fanatics, in whose damaged brains fashionable theories have easily taken root. The rest, for the most part, are simply predators, exploiting the established order and having adopted revolutionary dogma only because it promises to satisfy their lusts. From these scum of ignorance and vice, the Jacobin government recruits the best of its staff and cadres. These people usually live in a world of fantasy, a world of social and political illusion, rather than in the realm of reality. They exist outside of time and space, like children. They cannot and do not want to wait. They desire the immediate fulfillment of all of their intentions. And what he's trying to say is that it's very rare that their activists give a damn about abstract theory. They don't really care about the fanatics. They just want to have something, to cling to something in any cause. And by now you should be thinking of Dostoevsky, who said, "In troubled times, the fluctuation or transition, all sorts of scum, which exists in every society, always and everywhere, rise up. A life or death struggle ensues between the three main groups, as a result of which the ambitious gentlemen, the human zeros, and the bottomless surface quickly make the fanatical gentlemen and idealists a head shorter." In other words, they murder them. Now, I don't think there were 10,000 Masons in Russia. That's a very round figure. But it was still pretty large. In 1820, what we know, there are 32 Masonic lodges within the empire, has 1,600 members. Maybe there were some inaccuracies there. It's reasonable to say that it didn't exceed 2,000. But that doesn't matter, because their social standing was very high. These were the elite officers. These were the fanatics, people who believed that they deserved more than they were getting. After Alexander I eventually banned Freemasonry, and this is kind of naive of him, all Masons were required to sign pledges that they won't belong to a lodge. I guess it's so they can have a legal paper trail. I don't know. All these guys, you know, Pestel signed it. It's really almost a nonsensical thing. But Nicholas I, again, had to issue a decree, 1826, 1 year later, banning Freemasonry in Russia. This is now the fourth ban on it. But because this tiny leadership cadre or the upper levels of the nobility, using the losers and the scum, as we said before, as their hands and feet. They could very easily slip through the cracks. It was customary to especially in Soviet literature, to love and extol the participants and instigators of this attempted coup. And in Soviet literature, of course, the Decembrists were considered wonderful, great men. There was a film called The Captivating Star of Happiness. The leading actors and cavalry guards set to Okudzhava's poetry. And this was something that became the absolute zenith of the Decembrist legend. And this was deliberately built over the years. Now, it wasn't a very good film. The plot was very unclear because it doesn't even lay what exactly did the conspirators want. What were their goals? What were their aspirations? Why did they risk themselves and lead their men who trusted them to their deaths? They also had works of fiction, like Northern Lights by Xenia Amadich, Loyal Sons of Russia by Lev Nikulin, Notes of a Fencing Master by the French Dumas Pierre. But long before 1917, the myth of Decembrists had taken shape. They were aristocratic revolutionaries. They were terribly removed from the people. They were not romantic, but they imitated the romantic idealists. They talked about the happiness of the common people who they didn't know, who they didn't understand, who they had on their estates as serfs. Nikolai Karamzin says they were mad liberals, violent men who, in a fit of madness, decided on an undertaking as disastrous as it was impossible to hand over the state to an unknown power, overthrowing the legitimate one. Of course, he's talking about the Decembrist uprising. You know, Pestel, you know, he was going to destroy not only all the representatives of the Russian imperial house, but also the church. But to do that, you needed a very strong, if not a totalitarian, state system that looks like a republic. You can't start on this path and then lose an election and have to go back. That's not how this works. So they have to fake it. And thank God Almighty for Nicholas I, who kept him from implementing all of this. Now, it's funny to say this, but to the lower-level members, the scum, the people who the upper-level made fun of, called all these names, they convinced them that Tsar Constantine's wife was named Constitution. We want Constantine and Constitution, as if they were a couple. That Nicholas had illegally removed Constantine from the throne. The meaning of the word was very different, and it was actually quite difficult for Russian soldiers in the early 19th century. By calling Constitution a person is another form of manipulation. There was no other way to describe it to them in their minds. They lied. Of course, they functioned by deception. This little window, this tiny moment of the interregnum to seize power. Of course, it was based on a lie. And it was even worse than that because those who were spreading it knew what was going to happen to them. Relyov said, quote, I foresee that there will be no success, but a shock is necessary. We must begin. A beginning and an example will be beneficial. So this is why hundreds of soldiers were sent under the gauntlet? the wealthy in these groups did not fare all that badly after this was over. The guy who shot General Miloradovich was Kukovsky. Very cowardly act, very unexpected. He was even treated as a hero. There were plenty of people who wanted to stop this looming nightmare of a senseless and merciless Russian rebellion. After Kukovsky killed Miloradovich, Colonel Sterler killed him. Captain Vilo of the Life Guards Regiment lost an arm during the battle with the rebels. The Grenadiers Krasovsky and Moishev, who resisted the withdrawal of soldiers from the Moscow Regiment to the Senate Square, were hacked to pieces by Prince Shipin Rostovsky in a revolutionary fanaticism, that, you know, almost a seizure. He had gone berserk. Nicholas didn't want to do this. Nicholas didn't want to kill other Russians, especially over this. But he absolutely had no choice. The revolutionary whirlwind was only just beginning to swirl here in Russia. Yeah, the Decembrists were the first revolutionary movement in Russia. And we know this because they were the first to what Bashalov calls the first to cross the boundaries of the Gospel Commandments and public morality. In other words, trying to raise an armed mass of soldiers to fight against the historical state authority of Russia. The total and radical remaking of Russia as an empire. Nicholas I was tipped off about this by Yakov Rostovtsev. And after that, he wrote to the conspirators. He said, "Your actions will be the signal for the destruction of the state. Poland, Lithuania, Finland, Bessarabia, Georgia will fall away. Civil war might begin. Europe will exclude Russia from the ranks of the great powers and relegate it to Asia, etc." Now, this mentality, of course, is active today. And the only thing that, you know, they failed was, they failed in terms of division, in terms of command, and the distrust of Pestel, who clearly was a lunatic. Griboyedov, Alexander actually, referred to them as 100 ensigns who wanted to change the entire state system of Russia. They claimed to despise serfdom, but in the Helvetic Republic, taxes and debts were extremely high. There was a rule of revolutionary dictators plunging the country into civil war. Serf owners who wouldn't free their own serfs. They didn't inspire respect for this very reason. Clearly, they didn't believe what they were saying. This is one of the things where the esoteric and the exoteric had clashed. Nicholas's mother, the Dowager Empress Maria Fedorovna, said about those who appealed to the military merits of the conspirators during Napoleonic Wars, trying to justify what they did. She says, "The leaders of the mutiny themselves, based on their previous achievements, have no particular significance. There are men among them who serve well, but thank God bravery in Russia is a hereditary virtue among our military. In any case, it is grievous that they have tarnished their officer rank with their crime and plunged their parents and wives into despair with their bad behavior." Now, at the time, it wasn't well known, but today it is, that the documents, ideological documents of this movement, Muravyov's Northern Society, his constitution, Pestel's Russian Truth, Ruskaya Pravda, the Southern Society. Pestel was far more was far more radical. The Northern Society attempted to transform Russia from a unitary country into a federation, not along ethnic lines, but territorial lines, creating the disintegration and unrest. This was the creation of noble fiefdoms, in essence. Now, as far as the peasants are concerned, Nicholas I eventually freed state peasants with land that were actually working already, and of course the lands owned specifically by the royal family. Serfs were freed in some of the outlying republics already. Alexander I did that in the Baltics. But the Decembrists wanted to free them without land. And I don't think they had a conception of the commune. Freeing them without land would have been an utter and complete disaster. They would have been better off as serfs. In 1862, Alexander would emancipate the peasants with land. Now, the so-called redemption payments they had to pay were fairly low. They were under state-guaranteed terms, and the use of their land would be guaranteed. And those payments were eventually canceled. On the other hand, if the Decembrists had won, peasants would have had to rent land from the landowners, who would have now expanded their holdings under the landowners' terms. I mean, you had the Decembrists, they were being encouraged to free their serfs by Alexander. All the state support they needed. And not one of them did it under Alexander's decree of 1803. A lot of it had to be prepared outside of the public eye, because the media, distortion would have been awful. There were so many secret committees. These minor reforms ultimately led to the abolition of serfdom altogether. Nicholas I did a tremendous amount for the peasantry in general. He created local government bodies for the state-owned village. He created not only government bodies, but medical care and schools. And this was sort of a rehearsal for the later emancipation in the private sector. Nicholas forbade landowners from sending any serfs into penal servitude. They had the right to own land, engage in any entrepreneurial activity, and relative freedom of movement. By the end of his reign, about 200 upper-level nobles were under arrest due to their violation of serfs' rights. So he wasn't just talking. A monarch, especially a powerful one like Nicholas, isn't subject to these people. He doesn't go over their heads. He is over their heads. He doesn't need their support. And yet the Russian truth, Ruskaya Pravda of Pestel, this was done over the heads of the population. The main intention here was the merciless suppression of all resistance. This man was Machiavellian. True, all real revolutionaries are. He thought he had the ability to compel people to obey him. Part of that speech at a meeting of the society that I quoted early on, it's very similar to how Marx operated during the First International, when he was throwing out the anarchists and, especially Bakunin. What Pestel wanted, and ultimately what the Decembrists wanted, a despotic dictatorship of the revolutionary elite, which is a really long way of saying it was just going to be an oligarchy. He wrote a book on state governance, 1818-1819. He describes the Ministry of Police with a huge staff of informants and spies. He called them secret messengers. A huge network across the country. Now, Nicholas is condemned for having the third section in Petersburg had a few dozen people. The entire Gendarme Corps was maybe 2,000. But Pestel wanted his to be, in his final version, 150,000. But this is typical for all revolutionaries of this type. Nicholas I is condemned for being presiding over a police state. He had a handful of policemen. You know, there seems to be a law of revolutionary movements that whenever power is seized by a more moderate faction, the more radical one is going to take over very quickly. And you see this from Britain, the Glorious Revolution in Britain, all the way to, of course, Kerensky and Lenin in Russia. Now, the Decembrists did have military experience. These were not just people who were spoiled rotten. They had fought in the Napoleonic Wars. But they knew nothing about politics. They knew nothing about public administration. And this was an era in Russia where you believed that if you wrote something down, if something made sense on paper, you could then impose it on people. The violence to promote their agenda would have been extraordinary. But we have to give credit to Nicholas's determination. He did suppress the uprising in time. He knew it was going to happen. He didn't want it to happen. He was trying to calm it down. The Tsar was personally there on the square. He was risking his own life. He was no coward. And here's what Nicholas said, just as, in the old calendar, December 1314, he appeared before the assembled commanders and military units that were loyal to him, and he said, "Gentlemen, I don't think that this morning is going to pass without noise. It's possible that the palace will be under threat, and I cannot take the necessary measures in advance. I know there's unrest in some regiments, but only at the decisive moment, I'll be able to decide which units I can count on. Till then, I won't be able to measure the extent of the evil, but I am calm, because my conscience is clear. You know, gentlemen, that it was not I who sought this crown. I didn't want power. I didn't find it myself, either necessary, the talents, or the experience, to bear this heavy burden. But if the Lord wants to place it on me, as well as the will of my brothers and the laws of the state, I'll be able to defend it. And no one in the world will be able to wrest it from me. I know my duties. I know how to defend them. The emperor of all the Russes, if necessary, must die with a sword in hand. In any case, not knowing how, if we're going to survive this crisis, I entrust my son to you. As for me, even if I were emperor for only an hour, I'll be able to prove myself worthy of the title." But the Decembrists constantly talked about murdering the Tsar and the Tsar's family. That's not even the biggest point here. They were talking about, you know, slaughtering other Russians. Their men that they brought to the square, they knew many of them were going to die. Now, according to the police, there were 1,300 people killed on both sides. And they brought them there by deception. They knew that Nicholas was not a usurper. They knew that Constantine had renounced the throne. So these men who died on the Senate Square, they were brought there by deception. They were probably going to be killed. Of course, if they told the soldiers the truth, they wouldn't have obeyed them. Now, approximately 300 people were found guilty in the trials that came after this. Only 121 of these men were actually brought to trial. 36 sentenced to death. Sorry, were convicted. Sorry, 121 were convicted. 36 sentenced to death. The Tsar pardoned 31. The remaining five, hanging was substituted for quartering. The rebels' relatives suffered no harm. They weren't stripped of their positions or deprived of their rights, which, given the standards of the time, was pretty extraordinary. But, you know, in Soviet textbooks, the concept of Nicholas's cruelty after this, it takes up more space in the official textbooks than even the Patriotic War of 1812. Well, this changed Russia forever. It marked the end of the first period of Russia's Europeanization. It lasted a full 125 years. The hatred of the so-called order of the Russian intelligentsia, still harbored for Emperor Nicholas, stems from not any real flaws in his character or any of his shortcomings as a man or as a ruler, but because they lost. He didn't just defeat the Decembrists. This was the denationalized, globalized strata of high society, guided by Freemasonry. He was well aware of what their agenda was. This was a denationalized nobility. They were planning on a dictatorship. They followed this vicious idea established in the upper echelons of the nobility as a result of what happened in the 18th century. Sergei Platonov says this about the uprising. Platonov, of course, the famous historian. The attempts at a coup came from the same noble milieu that had similar attempts more than once in the 18th century. And the same guard had served as a similar instrument more than once in that era, was chosen as the instrument of the coup. In that century, coups sometimes succeeded, and the power they created acquired one or another character depending on the conditions of the moment. Now, in 1825, the attempt of a coup failed, but nevertheless, an influence was exerted on this new government. That's from his lectures on Russian history. Now, those who have been listening to me a long time know who exactly what I'm talking about. Lord Byron and people like that in the 18th century. But deep down, this is the exact same war that Ivan the Terrible was fighting. Yeah, things have changed. Social concepts have changed. Certain things took a new form, but deep down, it was the same idea. Keep in mind, as always, this was a purely elite movement. Emperor Paul, Alexander, they spoke out against the noble predominance. They created it, which existed in Russian society after the laws of Catherine. Now the authorities had to feel the direct need to emancipate themselves from this dominance because the upper nobility obviously was no friend of the crown. The gentry, having transformed into the nobility, ceased to be a reliable and convenient support for power because, in large part, they went into the opposition. Now we all know why. Same thing as in France. We have all of this money. We have all of this power locally. How come we can't have power nationally? I mean, that's very simple, but you know what I mean. Nicholas I and his successors couldn't handle this denationalized upper class. Nicholas was one of the few czars of the post-Petrian era who dared to punish these conspirators, because these always existed. Nicholas I was the first czar not from the nobility. And he had long since freed himself from the tutelage of the Europeanized and really denationalized nobility. He didn't rule for anyone's interest. Being a strong monarch meant that you already had the power. You didn't really need their assistance. Which is the most difficult path to choose? Fighting Freemasonry was very difficult. Over the years, this period of history has been terribly distorted. People who talked about the beautiful socialist future. For years, we were told that the Decembrists were sinless angels. There were saints in military uniforms and tailcoats. But we know what they really are. They're fanatics. They're political villains. They were Machiavellians. They were materialists. Had it not been suppressed, the Decembrists, driven by their desire to achieve the political fantasies as fast as possible, would, like the Bolsheviks, have shed rivers of Russian blood. They're not used to hearing no very often. Anyone who opposes the fanatic is usually swept away with ever-increasing ferocity. The Decembrists were defeated very quickly. You had a few dozen exiled. You had many deaths. You only had five executed. But you wouldn't have five executed. You would have had 5 million, maybe, had they won. Kolska's shooting Miloradovich in the back was symbolic. You can't revere the name of the Decembrists whatsoever. The idea of regicide was always part and parcel of the minds of the upper levels of the nobility. The mid and lower, different story. Many of them, at that day, December of 1825, they were wasted. They 184 buckets of wine for 1,000 men. They were doing nasty things to the local population. It was a riot, more than anything else. It's tough being objective here. But certainly what we're being told is not objective. They left a terrible legacy in Russian political life, what some have called the blood psychosis. It's a leftist phenomenon, and it leads back to the Decembrists. They were hypnotized by the French guillotine. They had harshly condemned the Neapolitan and the Spanish revolutions for not exterminating the royals there quickly enough. And it wasn't just them. Pestel had plans to uproot the entire intellectual class of Russia, the church to be completely demolished. And somehow freedom was to come out of this. Well, we all know where Dostoevsky got some of his ideas from, The Possessed. Again, a book I strongly recommend. And that's the legacy that it left the world with. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.